Welcome back to Distillery Sessions, Season 4, and we're kicking off with a bang. My name's Steve Ween, I'm founder of Distillery, and I'm excited that today I get to reconnect with Efrain, who I first met on a panel many moons ago. Efrain's passion and commitment around LGBTQ plus representation in the ad and marketing space was infectious back then, and I've stalked Efrain ever since on social, and I'm excited to dive into so much good stuff. From Efrain's role as WFA ambassador, what it was like judging at Cannes Lion this year, and so much more. Welcome, Efrain.
Thanks.
How about we start with your awesome role at Reckitt?
I'm the Global Creativity and Diversity and Inclusion Director within Reckitt's Marketing Excellence Practice. There's a lot of words in that title, but essentially what it means is that I lead our DE&I practice within the brand strategy remit. So I partner with our central brand teams who essentially own the brand equity as well as the innovation pipeline across all of the Reckitt brands. And what I do is I partner with them to help them understand beyond their brand purpose, what are the fights that they can bring to people, society, the environment, but also understanding the communities most impacted by those fights and ensuring that those communities are ingrained within the brand strategy, not just in a communication sense, but also in their innovation pipeline and how they bring their particular brands to life across the globe. So that's the D&I aspect. The new part of my job is the creativity element. As we know, we can't really deliver on inclusive communications and marketing without having a close relationship with the way our agency partners also think about those things. So they've added the creativity component to my role to really ensure that the strategic elements that we work on within the brand teams globally are also being integrated in the way we set up our agency relationships, what we measure, how we KPI and remunerate the agencies, always ensuring that we're creating the mechanisms for accountability to really ensure that our brands are doing the right things, creating that positive impact, and not just treating diversity, equity, and inclusion as window dressing. It's a bit of a unique role. I've not quite seen other large FMCGs with a role like this, where there's someone who full-time leads a DE&I practice within the brand strategy space, but also is the key owner of the creative agency of record relationships to ensure that those two things are really working symbiotically.
It sounds like such a really fascinating role with that true commitment to DE&I and embedding that through the creative and strategic function in the business. And I'd love to understand that some more. But first up, we were chatting just earlier and you mentioned Cannes this year. As a jury member, can you tell us a little bit more? Did you see some brilliant work?
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to be asked to join the jury for The Glass Lion, The Lion for Change, which is about highlighting and celebrating the brands and nonprofits that are creating real impact when thinking about gender equality and the issues that continue to sustain and persist in that particular space. So it was a really exciting experience for me. You know, of course, very passionate and committed to the way I can help brands deliver positive societal impact through diversity, equity, and inclusion. So to be invited to see all of the great work happening across the globe, we had almost 200 submissions in that particular category, which on one end feels small compared to categories like film and craft. But on the other end, still feels way too big that there are 200 Cannes-worthy campaigns and programs being submitted for a Lion, which means there is a growing amount of inequality that women still face. Women are still being period shamed. Women are still being oppressed and abused. Ideally, this category should be shrinking over time because the equity issues are being addressed in a systemic way, but the category is growing, unfortunately, which means that there are continuing to be more and more issues that aren't being addressed. So it was a bit of a sobering experience to see all of this great creative work, but also being constantly reminded of how far we have to go as a society still to ensure that women have the same health equities, the same opportunities, and aren't being abused and have the opportunity to find safety in 2023, right? The 70th year of the Cannes Lion. So It was also the 10th year of the Glass Lion. The Glass Lion is actually a relatively young lion, and it's the 10th year that the Glass Lion has existed. So I was very honored to be a part of it. And it was really motivating to see all of the great work teams, brands, creative partners, nonprofits around the world are really trying to create that positive change. And what I really loved seeing is the evolution of the way that they're trying to create positive impact through their work. Years ago, it was about, hey, look at this issue over here. We're wanting to draw attention and awareness to a particular issue, where this year felt very different. This year, it was, look at the systemic changes we're creating through our campaign work. It was more than say something. It's shifting to do something. And that's what I really enjoyed. It was quite interesting during the live judging that we have during the first 2 days of the festival. We were handed a draft law that a team is trying to push through parliament in their particular country to help create that systemic change. And that was quite an experience to be handed literally a draft law, boring, like a draft law, super boring to have to sit and read, but quite inspiring and exciting in the sense that these brands are looking to do more than just a quick flash in the pan initiative, but are really looking to make a lasting change. And that was probably the most exciting part of my whole jury experience, was to see that shift from say something into do something.
So getting your take on some of the best work you'd seen from Cannes Lions, I wasn't, to be honest, expecting you to shout out a piece of legislation.
Well, the Grand Prix winner this year was a campaign called Knock Knock from the South Korean police. It was simply a way for domestic abuse victims to be able to report their abusers in a way that enabled them to do it safely. There's a growing number of cases of domestic abuse globally, but in specific in South Korea. But what we find is that a lot of victims don't feel safe or able to report their abusers because they're likely living with their abuser. And two, oftentimes when the police do arrive after an emergency call is made, it just looks like a quarrel. So the police will often say, well, it seems like the quarrel is over. There's nothing else needed, because there's an inability for domestic abuse victims to record evidence. So this campaign was a way to solve all of those things. So essentially what the campaign created was, when someone calls the emergency service number 112, all they need to do is press any number twice as a knock knock, alerting the police that this person is unable to communicate in that moment, but are still in need. And when they knock knock, what it does is send that person a link on their phone that they click, and it immediately enables police access to the user's smartphone camera and microphone to immediately start documenting what's happening. Domestic abuse victims aren't able to report, but they're also not able to free themselves from their abuser, because without evidence, the abusers aren't able to be prosecuted and convicted. So this then enables for real-time evidence collection. What was also really clever about this program is that it also sends a dummy Google search page to the user's phone. So in case the abuser is able to see the phone screen, it looks like there's just a Google search on the screen, but in reality, it's actually a chat bot with the police department. So the victim is able to communicate in real time in a safe and private way, even within line of sight of the abuser. And it has helped women all over South Korea. They've sent thousands and thousands of these links after the knocks to domestic abuse victims, and they cleverly marketed it. They only marketed it in places that women were more likely to be at versus men. So nail salons, beauty parlors, they were able to kind of discreetly communicate to women that there is this ability to contact the police in a discreet way. And so that was our Grand Prix winner. Really loved the use of technology, solving a real problem, creating impact. This service now exists permanently within the police force in South Korea. So lives much longer than the campaign ever would be able to, which is really great to see. It's that shift from say something to do something, creating that real change. It was really important because domestic abuse is on the rise, especially after COVID. The other campaign I want to shout out was McDonald's AUF Equality Cup from Uruguay. This was such an ingenious yet simple program. Essentially, the problem they were trying to solve is that women's football, or as Americans like to call soccer, doesn't get the same attention, right? It doesn't get the same sponsorships. It doesn't get the same attendance. What they wanted to do is to kind of close that gap, specifically to ensure that women's football has the longevity, has the reach, right? Because if you can't see it, you won't be able to be it. And so being able to impact lots of young girls and women. And so what they did was very simple. They basically combined two Excel sheets and created a utter trophy. And what it did is it combined the men's score with the women's score and created a bracket that was the combination of both a team's men's and women's score, and then awards a trophy to the team with the highest overall score. It is simply combining two Excel sheets. They created a unique trophy for that particular program. It increased sponsorship. It increased viewership of the women's football matches. And it's now something that they're looking to bring to other countries and potentially other sports. And it's such a simple solution that helps create more equity within women's sports that has been really hard to crack for a long time. And it was just a really simple, beautifully executed solution. So those would probably be the two that I would call. I believe the McDonald's AUF Equality Cup won gold as well within the Lions category.
So was it pretty heavy going as a judge?
You know, we had to judge the near 200 entries by end of May because the Glass Lions is one of two categories that has live presentations, which essentially means those who make the shortlist come in on the first couple of days of the festival and get 12 minutes to present to the jury live why they should win a lion. And so we needed to be able to put our shortlist out early. So I was already prepared with how emotional judging this category was going to be, seeing all of the different issues that are still happening around the world being addressed by various brands and organizations. But I hadn't really prepared myself for sitting in the live presentations because the people behind the work are super motivated, super passionate. And there were tears shed, there were laughs had. And so it was like a lot of ups and downs throughout that judging experience that was really heart-wrenching, but also really inspiring to see the progress being made and the change that others are trying to create in the world. So it was a great experience. It'll be definitely a career highlight for myself, just being able to be a part of that jury. I hadn't prepared myself for how much the emotion of the presenters was really going to impact me because these are people who are really trying to use the power of their creativity, of their brand and their clients to really create lasting, impactful change. And it was quite moving to see a lot of the work that they were doing.
In terms of connection, connecting brands to broader societal issues, from our chat earlier, you touched on the Reckitt Way. Could you give us an introduction to the Reckitt Way?
Yes, of course. It's interesting. The Reckitt approach to impactful brand building is a bit specific. I think you've probably seen a lot of large multinationals have sustainability initiatives, D&I initiatives, creativity initiatives. And what Reckitt does is we bring all those together because they really shouldn't live separately. And they're most powerful when you bring them together. So how we approach it is each one of the Reckitt brands aligns to one of the 17 United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And those, if you are not familiar, are essentially the world's to-do list. It's 17 issues that we need to address to have a more sustainable planet and fairer society for all of us. And so each Reckitt brand aligns to one SDG where it can make a meaningful and measurable impact. And within that, that's how they can bring their purpose to life. But more importantly, it's what fight that they can take because it's about being active. Purpose is very passive. It's why you exist, right? So it feels very passive by nature. What we do is we pick a fight. And when you pick a fight, you have an enemy. And when you have an enemy and a fight, you also know who's fighting that fight the most or who can be benefited most. So we bring all of those things together to be able to create positive societal impact that not only benefits the business, but has that lasting change. I think one example I can give you that kind of helps make it clear is our Nurofen business, which is an analgesics. It's an over-the-counter pain medicine. And so the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal that Nurofen is aligned to is SDG 3, good health and well-being. Seems pretty obvious, right? We're a pain treatment product. So of course, that's what the SDG we would align to. So if the purpose of Nurofen is to put people, not pain, in charge of life, also not super revolutionary, quite obvious. But if that's the brand purpose, we need to then understand what might be getting in the way of people being in charge and not pain. And we know 8 out of 10 people suffer daily pains. And when those daily pains go unaddressed, they become chronic pains. Yet women are suffering chronic pain more than men. Women also have more pain types than men due to their physiology. And they also have more pain occurrences. So they have, by volume, more pain. We know these things, right? These are facts. Yet we see women don't treat as often, even though they have more pain types and more pain by volume. And in fact, it's been well researched and documented that women don't have the same access to good health than men do. Even so much so that the UK government put out a report saying that, yes, women do not have equal access to healthcare. If Nurofen believes in its purpose to put people, not pain, in charge of life, but yet we can also acknowledge that women are disproportionately not able to be in charge because pain is in the way, we had to understand why. And when we did that research, we know that there are biases that interfere with women getting access to pain. Women are often told that their pain is emotional or it's stress-based, or that's just what it is to be a woman. You have to deal with that pain. And so there's all these biases that exist within the healthcare system, but also healthcare practitioners like GPs and pharmacists. So Nurofen said, in order to put people in charge and not pain, we have to be able to tackle those biases so women aren't being blocked from getting access to fast and appropriate pain treatment. So the brand, of course, has put communications out there. But the important thing around the actions we take is Nurofen is measuring the gender pain gap with partners to understand, is this gap growing or closing? It's also working with its partners like GPs and pharmacists and bringing anti-bias training to them to ensure that when a woman comes forward with, I have pain, that we're training our network of GPs and pharmacists to really hear that and enable support for them to help close that gender pain gap. The brand is also committed to maintaining gender balance in all of its clinical research, because so often within healthcare more broadly, women aren't included in clinical trials. So the average medicine that goes to market isn't necessarily made for women. It's typically made for men, because that's who's included in clinical trials. By identifying an SDG, SDG 3, good health and well-being, understanding its purpose, but more importantly, finding a fight and understanding who's impacted by that fight the most and then taking the action, that's how Reckitt connects sustainability, diversity and inclusion, brand growth, and creating value for society, and in this particular case, women.
So you've taken up the fight, connecting those different elements. How are you going to go about measuring success?
We just started measuring it. The first gender pain index report went out in Q4 of last year. So we know that there's a lot of work to be done before we actually start to see movement on that. We're going to redo the measure later this year, and we'll continue to do so in the years coming. And we're doing it through surveys, not only with consumers, but we're also talking to medical professionals as well. And in terms of the results on the business, this work has driven some of the highest favorability numbers for the Nurofen brand that it's seen in years, because we know it's a real issue. You know, in the UK's report on women's health inequalities, a lot of the feedback that came from that particular government research was that men are also identifying that their wives, their children, their daughters, their sisters, the women in their lives are having a hard time getting access to appropriate medical treatment. So it's also something that, while it's focused on creating equity for women, is something that's also motivating and important for men as well. So it's been really great in terms of the early numbers that we've seen on the brand campaign. And we're hopeful to see some progress when we measure the next round of the gender pay gap, because it is so important to us. And we're quite confident based on the brand measures that we're seeing that there hopefully should be some movement. But listen, women's health inequity is not something Nurofen can address by itself, but we certainly have an obligation to help address it because we're the world's number one ibuprofen brand. So we would rather do something than sit back and do nothing, because it's been far too long known that women have not had the same health outcomes as men. So we're really inspired. You can see the motivation that happens across the business when we're talking about how we close the gap and the way in which our teams within the company are reinvigorated on this brand and this mission to help close the gender pay gap. So we're quite confident that if we keep the course, we'll see some tangible results and progress.
Amazing. I'll link to the Nurofen See My Pain microsite with a link to the report in the comment section below the podcast. I wanted to move on to your role with the WFA. As one of their four global ambassadors, could you share a little bit more about the WFA and perhaps some of the industry issues it aims to address?
Sure. The WFA is the World Federation of Advertisers. It's essentially an industry body with hundreds of membership bodies like the ANA in the US and other kind of associations, ISBA in the UK. They're all members of the WFA, along with brands and agencies as well. And so I am one of four WFA global D&I ambassadors, and we work with the global WFA D&I task force, which is a coalition of brands, agency organizations, platforms even, that all come together to try to create a movement within advertising on how brands, agencies, platforms can all push forward and try to create change when we think about diversity, equity, and inclusion within our industries. So we publish white papers, we look to tackle upcoming issues and where the industry needs to move forward on. We also run global DE&I census, which looks at the makeup of the industry. So are we bringing in diverse talents? Are we nurturing them? Are people feeling that their work experiences are equitable and what that lived experience is like in this industry when we think about people's intersectional identities? And the second wave of the WFA DE&I census just came out, and the numbers are quite sobering. We haven't seen much progress between the first year we did it and the second year that we've now done it. We know that it's a bit of a call to action for brands and agencies to do more. So this WFA D&I task force is meant to be a brain trust, if you will, of different organizations to help push the needle forward when it comes to D&I in marketing, D&I in suppliers, D&I within the task force, D&I within how we buy media. It's really trying to think about inclusion as part of everything that an advertiser would do.
Obviously, it's an incredibly important organization. What are some of the challenges that you face?
Listen, there are always going to be challenges that the task force faces, especially when we think about bringing all of these big brands together to try to collectively solve, right? There's the, is this competitive intel that we shouldn't be sharing? What I love about the group is that we don't really come from that place. We come from a place of, we have an opportunity as a collective to create systemic change as to how brands and advertisers can really do more when it comes to creating diversity, equity, and inclusion on and off camera, but also with the power of these brands, right? When you're thinking about our membership body, we have Unilever, P&G, Reckitt, Mars. These are huge brands that have great power and influence within the industry, but also within society, right? Advertising creates culture. So to bring this group of brands and thought leaders together to really think about how we can do better within the industry for D&I, it's really great. And the challenges are always going to be, how do we do more and how do we do it faster? And we want to create change, but creating equity within this industry is going to take a long time because it's built on centuries of inequity. It's going to be something that is going to be continually needing to be worked on. But That's what I also love about the task force. I've been on the task force for a few years, and we still have the same members showing up, contributing, pushing the agenda, and really trying to create that change. So it's really motivating for me to be a part of that group, to see that there is a collective that want to leave a positive impact with what they do within their own company.
I was reading that the WFA has developed a 12-step creative process around eliminating bias and bringing belonging. Could you talk us through the process perhaps and touch on some examples?
Yeah, so I believe it was in March 2021, the WFA released this 12-step guide on how to eliminate bias within the creative development process for all marketeers and agencies to be able to use. And it really covers from brand strategy all the way through measurement on what are the different areas that we should be interrogating to ensure that inclusion is being brought through the entire time. You know, so often I see brands only think about diversity and inclusion at casting. That's way too late in the process. Like I had mentioned in the Reckitt model, we think about it like at the brand strategy level, like who are the communities we can disproportionately benefit? And once that's been defined, you're then able to make sure that that group's voice and perspective is at every stage of the development process. The WFA guide is essentially how you can do that, how you can think about the communities you can benefit, how you think about incorporating them in your insights work. So often when we do insights, it's de-averaged. And so it's just looking at a group of people without any nuance or differentiation. And that then immediately impedes your ability to create positive impact because you don't actually understand the lived experience of the consumers that are relevant to your category, the fight that your brand may have chosen. So the guide really helps you understand at every step of the process how you might need to think or interrogate that standard or step in the development process to ensure you've got it at the core, right? For example, Nurofen. If Nurofen didn't bring a D&I perspective to insights, we would just always be looking at pain sufferers. And pain sufferers, we would have the average understanding of what it's like to have pain. But when we break it by gender, right, because we found that gender was an identity that creates a health equity gap, we would never have seen that women have more pain, they have more pain types. And so then we wouldn't be able to understand that they're undertreating and then be able to unpick why that might be. So it's in your strategy, in the way you do insights, of course, how you write it in your brief, how you think about bringing an agency on board, right? I think a lot of teams, you don't really live by the words, nothing for us without us. And I think that's so critical to getting DE&I and positive impact work correct, is you need to be bringing those voices into the process. It's not just putting them in front of the camera. You need to make sure that they are actively playing a part in the development of the work. It goes all the way through to how you buy your media. If you say you care about one thing, but then you invest in your media in a completely different way, that can be problematic and disingenuous. I'll give a great example of our Durex business. Durex has stood for the LGBTQ+ community for years and has done lots of work in creating awareness, but also how we create sexual education equity for queer youth, because that's often not covered in typical sex ed programming. What we found by interrogating the way we buy media was that actually our brand safety controls were getting in the way from the brand to be able to invest in queer journalism. So if we say we care about the queer community, but our brand safety approach doesn't allow us to invest in the appropriate way in queer voices and queer issues, we're not really living and breathing that mission. The guide really helps you think about every step of the creative development process and what types of questions you should be asking in meetings to ensure that you're really bringing that key community all the way through the whole process. It's available for free. So if you're listening to this, please visit the WFA, download it. It's a simple PDF and will give you an arsenal of questions that you can ask in almost any meeting to ensure that you're bringing a DE&I perspective into all the work.
Awesome. I'll add a link in the description of the podcast. Now, one of the other pieces we discussed in prepping for this session was all around belonging. And it's something I wanted to see if we could dive into a little deeper.
My role is in within the marketing practice. And so belonging often feels like HR territory. But I think as marketeers, we have the opportunity and responsibility to create that sense of belonging when we think about the creation of our communications. I had mentioned earlier that a lot of brands really are looking to create more diversity in front of the camera. And that's great. But you also need to think about what are the real life implications of bringing more diverse talent into a same shared space for a production. And so at Reckitt, we've partnered with a company named Talent Trust. What they're looking to do is to advocate for talent on and off camera in production to ensure that they feel psychologically safe, physically safe, and have the opportunity to communicate any issues or opportunities to make that production more welcoming. So for example, Black talent, brands will want to cast Black talent because the industry still to this day hires majority white talent. So there's been a push to have more Black talent on camera, which is wonderful. But what isn't necessarily being thought of is, do you have hair and makeup talent off camera that knows how to work with textured hair or darker skin tones? So often that doesn't go addressed within kind of pre-production meetings and how we set up our actual sets and the people we bring on to the set. So much so that when we did an audit of several hundred production suppliers, we found that not one of them had DE&I principles or a charter on how to care for a more diverse talent pool that, of course, the advertisers are asking to be brought on set and in front of the camera. So in partnering with Talent Trust, we've created that charter. So every Reckitt production that partners with Talent Trust has a very clear, these are the expected behaviors. We expect all of the players who help bring our communications to life to adhere to. And that covers things like safety, respect, timeliness, preparedness, to ensure that all of the talent can bring their best selves to the work and know that they're going to be taken care of. Because if you're an advertiser and you're asking for more diversity on camera because you want to communicate to the broader public that you care about those communities, you need to also care for that person you've hired to represent that community. And that means thinking about these things. So when we've implemented this talent charter, it also comes with a feedback mechanism where talent is able to anonymously report back what their experience was like on a Reckitt shoot. And we use that data and information to help us remunerate and KPI our production partners. So if you want to be a preferred Reckitt production partners, you need to create spaces and sets and teams that enable diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. And what we found is when we implement this work, talent tells us they would prefer to work on a Reckitt shoot over any other shoot that they've done previously. And that makes total sense, right? We're going and taking the steps to ensure that everyone's being taken care of, right? It is very common in the industry that private dressing rooms aren't even offered. It feels so simple and fundamental, but often those things aren't necessarily being thought of in a very clear way. So with our charter, we're able to communicate to our production partners, our agency, but also the talent as to what we expect as the advertiser, and then give the feedback mechanism to inform us if they are being met or not. And then we use that information to help us have conversations with our preferred partners to make sure that everyone is delivering against those expectations. And it's something I'm really passionate about. It's something that we often don't think about because we're so focused on like the end product of the marketing and creative development process. But we need to be thinking about how we make those things just as much.
Your passion is infectious, and ultimately what you're talking about must make better work. Now, I'd love to hear more about the upcoming white paper.
Several members of the WFA's D&I task force have really kind of started to understand this particular nuance within creating great work and have launched several initiatives with different partners to help solve this challenge around creating that safety and belonging on set. We're still working to bring all of those partners together with their different models and essentially be able to open source the approach that the different brands and their partners have taken, and then publish that in a white paper so other brands, other agencies can see how we're tackling it and potentially even lift and shift it into the way they do their business, because it shouldn't be something that we keep private and close to our chest. It's something that the task force cares about, and we want to make sure that we're creating that industry-wide change, which is our mission. So I think we're looking at a Q4 2023 or a Q1 2024 publication of this white paper that will help brands, advertisers, and production companies create diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging within the onset experience.
Wow, we've covered so much ground today, from Cannes to sustainability, and of course DE&I, all the way through to creative development process and production. Thank you so much for joining me.
No, thank you for having me.
And thank you for joining us wherever you're listening to Distillery Sessions. Something Efrain mentioned to me after we stopped recording really stopped to make me think. He said, "I hope this recording inspires someone or a few people at least to think how they can bring action into their day-to-day. Just because someone has DE&I in the title can almost be like a curse. Everyone expects it's their sole responsibility to do it. But in actuality, it's all of our responsibilities to do something about it. So hopefully someone hears something in this and decides to bring that into their day-to-day work." I just wanted to include that at the end of this podcast episode. I hope this recording has given you some inspiration. Check out the resources, give Efrain a follow, and don't forget to hit that subscribe button. See you next time.